Yes, that's my strange way of introducing our next guest, Stan Deo. Actually, Earth changes. We are going through some major ones, and he is next on Coast to Coast AM. Stan Deo has held above top secret security clearances, worked undercover for the FBI. He was part of an exclusive black project headed by Dr. Edward Teller, specializing in the development of flying saucer technology. He has lectured on many world events, including, of course, global economic collapse, developing solar-related crises in the Earth's climate, the UFO deception and its real intent, suppression of badly needed technologies, high voltage physics of cheaper energy. This is basically going to be a two-part program tonight with Stan. We're going to talk about major Earth changes affecting all of us and also a plan to develop a flying saucer. Stan, tell me you liked that introduction song, please.
I did, George. That was a hoot. You and Tom must have got together and worked that up.
We've been kicking that around for about a year and a half now. And not until I finally got to know you and meet you did I say, you know what, he may laugh at this. He'll like that.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Gosh, yeah. I tell you what, it lightens the mood. I love it. We occasionally we'll get that here at home, and somebody will come in and remind us of our song.
From now on, I'll play it every time you're on
the
air.
Thank you, sir. it's welcome.
How's Holly doing?
I'm doing fine. Holly is too. We've been working all day trying to get some talking points up on the website there for you to give to your listeners, you know, pictures so they can follow along what we're doing. I was just listening to the interview with Marty and Shirley, and I got to confess something to you. I mean, my early youth was kind of built around those movies or the musicals of the Music Man and Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Pat Boone's thing, you know, the April Love. I saw those movies several times, you know, and even learned some of the lyrics. I sang them in the shower to myself, but, you know.
Well, you know, Stan, you know, it's not traditional Coast to Coast, but, you know, I figure when I'm out here, I want to tap into some real people who have had such an incredible influence on a lot of people's lives in this country. And, you know, Shirley Jones and Marty Ingalls and Pat Boone and all the other people that have been on this program in these kinds of vignettes that we do have really affected us. And, you know, they deserve the credit. They deserve to talk to their fans. And so we're going to do that every once in a while.
Oh, I think it's a great idea. And you're so right. They have really put good things into the American community, I think, in all the work they've done. So
absolutely.
My hat's off to them.
Hey, Stan, in a couple parts we'll talk about this. Next hour we'll talk about this incredible push for flying saucers and flying saucer technology. But this first hour, unbelievable catastrophic changes we continue to see on this planet. Hurricanes that seem to very quickly get to Category 5s. Floods that take lives. I mean, just what in the heck is going on with this planet, Stan?
Well, I think there are two things to look at. I'm not oblivious to the weather modification warfare techniques and devices that most of the major powers have developed over the last 30 years. But we also have added to that the sun itself, which is a major player in the global warming. Not the only player. Obviously, I still think that greenhouse gases and just life, you know, the emissions from life are causing part of the global warming. But in the end, the energy for that comes from the sun. And the sun is not constant. We used to think that it's solar constant. You know, its output would be about 1,372 units, and that would be it. But it's now varying by about 0.1%. And it's increasing. It's been doing that since the mini ice age in the late 1500s. It's called the Maunder minimum.
And it doesn't take much, Stan, does it, to affect us?
Good Lord, no. I mean, it's a very delicate balance. It's a miracle that life has even been allowed to live on the planet. It's such a fine window. If we were to move 2% closer, 2% further away from the sun in our orbit for some reason, we wouldn't have life on the planet like this. It'd be totally different, if at all.
Over the last couple of weeks, people in St. Louis, my friends, have been calling me saying, George, we can't take this anymore. It's been a long time since St. Louis has had a run, and I mean weeks together, of 100-plus degree weather. And then when you add that incredible summer humidity in St. Louis, that heat index, Stan, goes way, way up. And I got to thinking, and you are absolutely right, I'm saying to myself, just a few degrees from the sun, just a few, and you're talking about less than that, yep, affects this planet in such a way that people can't live anymore if it hits to be 100 or 110. I mean, the body shuts down, Stan. People were dying.
Oh, I know, and we've had flooding, you know, in the area you're talking about there, in the Missouri area there. I'm just looking at the map now. Above average flood risk this year, coupled with that heat, it makes it unbearable. I mean, you can't breathe in that kind of stuff. Holly used to live in the area years ago, and she said that when it got humid and hot, you couldn't breathe. You know, you'd lay down and just kind of gasp for breath at night. But this is worse than that, I think.
Now, you have predicted, and you used to predict, earthquakes quite a lot.
Yeah.
Now, I'm starting to hear that you're not doing that anymore. What's going on?
Well, in November of last year, the information source that I was using to derive the forecast, which were about 70% accurate, was the United States Navy information station in Monterey, California. It's called the FNMOC, the FNMOC, Fleet Numerical Meteorological something.
Okay. And these were temperatures too, right?
Well, they were temperatures of the seawater on the surface. And the Navy had, and still does have, access to sea surface buoys, to submarine surface craft, and satellites and aircraft, which makes their access to data to prepare this sea surface temperature variation much better than, say, like NOAA, who I can now use some of their stuff, but it's not anywhere near as timely and as accurate, high resolution, as the Navy's was. Well, anyway, in November, the Navy, who had been letting us all use that data in a declassified form for 10 years, actually about 10 and a half years, stopped and said, oh, well, it's not going to happen anymore. We're deleting this from the public website. And the reason was that they were changing to new satellites with new frequencies and new programs, and this wasn't a high-priority thing for them, this sea surface temperature anomaly that I used. And so, therefore, it would be discontinued for an indefinite time, and when they got around to it, they might put it back up, which they've never done. They've just gone to the COLA images and NOAA images. So I can't be as accurate as I was before, I can see the big ones. And certainly about 2 or 3 days before the Peru earthquake, we got strong signals, which are up on the website, actually, if you go to standeo.com.
And that's DEYO. Okay.
I think it's under earthquake alert there. When you get into the page up in the upper right, it'll be earthquake alert. And you'll see August 14, 15, and 19. And right now, even, we're looking at possibly some more earthquakes over in Ecuador, Peru, because we're getting a similar signal again. And so it's still in the testing stage because I'm having to improvise with data that's not quite as good as it used to be. But it falls into line with something that we've all kind of been talking about, and the news has certainly been talking about it, and that is the suppression of information from USGS and NASA scientists, or any of us for that matter, that are officially employed by the government. And it's a gag order, in essence. I've read it. It's not fiction. It tells government employees if they need to notify their superiors, if they notify the appropriate authorities in Washington, that they're going to have an interview with the press, or they're going to say something about something that might be alarming to the public. And before they can go out with it, they have to get it cleared. If they don't get it cleared and make an interview, they have to record as much of the details as possible and immediately submit it to the committee or to their boss, who then sends it to the committee. So in essence, they are trying their best to keep the population of the country calm in the midst of things that you and I and everyone out there in the United States know are not right. I mean, bird movements, that migrations that are abnormal, fish things that are abnormal, temperatures that are abnormal, humidity abnormal, rainfall. Like in Colorado, where we are, we've had beautiful rain here in the high desert. I mean, things are blooming. We've had two springs this year.
What's up is down. What's down is up, Stan.
Absolutely.
It?
And they're extremes. They're not just a reversal of where they used to be, like you'd get when you had an El Nino versus a La Nina condition. These are extremes. Hurricanes turning into Category 5, that used to be, it didn't happen. And here we have...
And if it did, it was rare. Now it seems it happens every other year.
Well, they had to increase the scale on the hurricane rating. I mean, because of it. It's...
Why are these scientists being muzzled exactly, Stan? Why aren't they allowed to say what they want to say?
Well, all right, let's take one case here where Australian scientists were being gagged on greenhouse emissions because of rising sea levels. And that was published in 2003 in the national Australian newspaper called The Australian. And they wanted to, the scientists there wanted to warn people on the coastal areas and islands around the Pacific and in Asia region that they were going to lose islands, they were going to lose seafront property. And while Holly and I were still down there before this article even came out, they were telling us, the government of Australia, don't buy property on the Queensland coast, the New South Wales coast, which is the east coast of Australia, because the sea level rise is going to be reclaiming property that you're trying to buy, and we can't insure you. And so these scientists were trying to tell everybody in great detail of that, and, you know, they were hit with a gag order. That's just Australia. I mean, they were nowhere near what's happened here, but our scientists here are told, in your private work, if you publish a novel, you have to get it vetted by us first. And this comes from the White House. They don't want the truth about global warming put out there. They don't want the truth about what NASA's experts are trying to say. All these people have been hit. In fact, on the website, if you click on that page there and go to Threat Watch for the talking points, it says Earth Changes Talking Points. You just click on that, and you'll get down to the section where Holly's prepared a list of links to these stories I'm talking about. It's down at the bottom. It's called Silence is Golden?
Right.
And just reading you the titles, What Government Doesn't Want You to Know, and Rewrote the Science. Climate expert says NASA tried to silence him. Global warming, scientists silenced, officials say. Muzzle climate researchers feeling heat from White House. Climate and ocean scientists put under new speech restraint. Australian scientists gagged on greenhouse emissions and rising sea level. Australian scientists encouraged to resign over climate warning. Federal science told not to speak about his novel. Government also acts as 15 Kyoto research programs. Minister stops book talk by Environment Canada, and the list goes on. I mean, I tried to put myself in the position of the White House, and I said, all right, look, if we have anarchy in the country, mm-hmm. people breaking down, you know, law and order and looting.
Panic everywhere.
Yeah, we don't want that. And I can understand from that viewpoint why they are trying to kind of put a lid on anything that would inflame people rather, you know, and excite them, frighten them, rather than educate them slowly. And so what is happening is we're seeing a number of government agencies, federal, state, and local, who are doing emergency prep training of their community.
Right under our noses, Stan. Right under our noses. And we really don't understand why they're doing it. We think it's just practice exercising. I don't think it is.
No, it isn't, and it's following exactly what I would probably have done in the same position to try to avoid panic. And Holly has written that book, the Dare to Prepare book, on emergency preparation for people in all these kind of situations you'll see listed here on the Threat Watch, because we wanted to try to educate people. We were given the opportunity by the government, by what they have done, to educate people in a calm and detailed manner way ahead of the events, which are now upon us, so that they could endure them and accommodate them without so much trauma in their lives. We're trying to put a good ending on the story here.
So you would, I guess, if you were running the show, would you be doing things the same way, or would you try to get us a little better prepared?
I think they are getting us better prepared because, look, I've felt no pressure at all, neither has Holly, from any government agency about doing what we're doing. In essence, they let us unofficial sources of preparation speak out on the radio, speak out on TV, speak out on our websites and books, because we are unofficial. And should any of us go to the extreme of panicking people without giving them solutions, then we could easily be discredited and put down as
quacks or unofficial.
Yeah,
right?
And that would calm the waters. And I think I would have to do it the same way. I don't, at this point in our development, before this, I would have probably done it a different way. But at this late date, I think that's probably the wisest step that could be made, as much as I hate to say it.
But there's no question, Stan, in your mind that something is happening to this planet. And I'm not just talking about global warming, and let's not argue the merits of what's causing it. We all know it's happening. It's obvious.
Yep.
But you're not talking about that. There's something else afoot here. This planet is going through some major planetary crisis.
Yes. There's an interesting article that Holly's got on the site under the picture of the volcanoes. In recent studies, in July this year, the investigating teams in the Pacific Ocean have been looking at a small portion of all the undersea volcanoes on the planet. The reason they're doing this is to trying to, from these volcanoes and their height and emissions and their cone sizes, determine what is happening in the core of the Earth and the pressures on the mantle. And they have found, George, they have found about 3 million submarine volcanoes, 39,000 of which rise more than 1,000 meters, or about 3,000 feet, over the seabed.
That's like a slow burn if you're boiling water, isn't it?
Yeah, well, look, absolutely. And these things form primarily along the plate tectonic borders, you know, where the tectonic plates of the Earth push and slide across each other. Now, the it's not Armstrong. It's anyway. There's a guy that I quote one of my books in Oxford, who has done a great research paper among others that have done the same thing about the diameter of the Earth and how it has changed over, you know, the eons of it being in existence. And one of the things that is very obvious from these studies is that it's W. G. Owen. Sorry, O. W. E. N. The thing that has come from this study is that the Earth has increased its whole diameter by 20 to 25% since its original formation. The continents are split apart, and if you look at a map and try to push in your mind, push all the continents back together, as Owen and others have done, you'll see that there is an orange slice kind of empty spot between where the coastlines touch, but the coastlines are similar, like they were once joined. And this would happen if you had them on a smaller globe. They would all touch, but as you expand it, it would pull apart, make that crescent-shaped, orange slice-looking cavity between them. And there's so much evidence coming to the forefront now about the dinosaurs, the strength of gravity, the thickness of the atmosphere, how much oxygen was here, all kinds of things, all relate back to an Earth with a faster spin rate, you know, like a shorter day, and a smaller diameter. And we're watching these volcanoes now because in some of the flood legends in the Middle East, like in the biblical account, they talk about the fountains of the deep putting up hot water. It wasn't just cool water. From the fountains of the deep under the ocean floor erupted and put hot water into the upper seas from a water shell that's called the Moho Discontinuity now, about 5 to 10 miles beneath the surface.
You know, scientists have lost 80% of the dolphins that they have been tracking, I think, around the Florida area.
Yeah.
They don't know where they are.
Yeah, I tell you what, things are really, really about to change.
If that's not a barometer, you know what? These dolphins are smart. They're probably smarter than we are. They probably have gone they've taken off somewhere.
Well, up in Alaska, there's a volcano, Pavlov, I think, going off now. And just this evening, we got an email from one of your listeners up there. We'll just call her Ms. M. She wanted to remain anonymous, but she was talking in Alaska. And near the Dixon entrance up there, how the eagles and the blue jays and the kingfishers and robins and blackbirds are all gone, just like the dolphins are gone. And we're seeing reports of this from all over the planet about animal migrations or disappearances, and they must be going deep to get out of, you know, the wave action
that's
going to occur.
And here's the strange thing, too, Stan. People, and you can talk to anybody. People are feeling weird. We'll open up the phone lines later tonight. People are feeling strange. And I don't think this is a feeling of terrorism or anything like that, though that could be part of the equation here. But there's just a weird physical feeling with people. It's changing their mood. There's something happening on this planet. Stay with us. Stan Deo, our special guest. We'll talk about the Edgar Cayce map, the Gordon Michael Scallion map, the Lori Toy map, and get Stan's take on all that, and also 2012, and more to come with Stan Deo right here on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest this hour, and for the rest of the night, Stan Deo, Earth Changes This Hour. He's flying saucer technology. Next hour, your calls the hour after that. But let's not forget Mr. Al Bielek as well, Philadelphia Experiment, great gentleman, up in age, looking for some help, and we decided, let's do it. Pick up an After Dark newsletter, renew, you'll get a free CD, an Art Bell Classic interview with Al Bielek about the Philadelphia Experiment, that ship that just almost disappeared. It's a classic. It's a classic. 1-888-727-5505. That's a toll-free number. Operators are there now. 1-888-727-5505. You can also go online, coasttocoastam.com. A donation. We will give a donation to Al Bielek when you subscribe or renew your After Dark newsletter. This has all the makings of one of those programs you've got to hear tonight. Stan Dale with some incredible information. Stan, Edgar Cayce, Gordon Michael Scallion, Lori Toy, all of them putting together what they believe to be Earth changes in a map form. But strangely, all three of them seem to agree and have agreed that we're going through some incredible planetary structural changes. I mean, the United States, for example, in all their maps is greatly altered. What's your take on all of that?
Well, several things. From a scientific point of view, we would have to have an enormous sea level rise to do all of what they say, unless some areas of the coastal United States on the West Coast subside or get broken off as part of the plate fracturing that they've talked about. You'll find during the break, Holly put up what I call the Hopi sea rise map on that Threat Watch page, where we're talking about the Earth changes. And if you go down to the bottom of the pictures, in the last row in the middle, it says Flood Outlook US 48, blah blah blah. Right underneath it says Hopi sea level rise map. And we made this after a visit, a couple visits actually. We were invited down to the Hopi Nation, and through a number of things that happened, they decided to let us in on a few of the prophecies they have. And one of them was that there, before the fifth age starts, that water would come up to between their mesas there in northwest Arizona, near Grand Canyon, and that the water level would be such that they would have to go by canoe between their mesas. So when I came home, I got a topographical, height map of the United States, and that's what Holly's put up there, did in color, showing what would happen if we had, 50, 100, 200 feet of sea level rise, and then showing also the areas where the Hopi said that the water would intrude over in the western United States.
So here then would become a fourth strong possibility mixed in with the three I just mentioned.
Absolutely. In fact, if I recall correctly from the maps that you, the people you mentioned, they show that a great opening will occur, or like a waterway will occur from the Great Lakes down to the Gulf of Mexico direct, and that will split off the right half of the United States to the eastern half. And that does, I mean, the levels of the rivers and the deltas there, which are filled in by blue on my map, do join the Great Lakes down to the Gulf of Mexico with a sea level rise.
Jeez, no wonder you're working on flying saucer technology. It might be the only way to get to the other side.
Well, George, absolutely. I'm looking at islands forming over on the West Coast, particularly around California and the San Joaquin Valley area. And if you've got islands, all right, there will be some boat traffic. But I thought if we could make a low cost, single or two man vehicle that would be quite safe and take little fuel, that you could island hop that way with medicine and supplies.
All right, we'll talk about that next hour, Stan. That's incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, what's your timetable though on these major Earth changes? I mean, these are pretty drastic.
Well, it's going to be gradualism. I think we're looking at probably zero from now over the next, 7 to 8 years that we'll start to see some of this begin, but it will continue, I think, for probably maybe a decade or two.
See, I think it's starting now, Stan.
Well, that's zero. That's right now,
yeah.
And I agree.
Right.
I mean, I just got an email from one of your listeners who's blasting me for frightening people about global sea surface temperatures, and he says the global surface temperatures of the planet have only increased about 0.6 of a degree centigrade in the last 100 years. Well, what he failed to realize is that, yeah, that's true, but 100 years ago they started at none, and then suddenly nothing, and then a little bit more, and then suddenly got really steep as the temperature increase starts now.
This is happening quicker.
It's happening quick. It's like an exponential curve, and he hasn't realized that it follows exactly sunspot numbers. The sunspot number curves that we plot and analyze, the temperatures of the sea follow that exactly. The deviation is just minimal. And this tells us that the seas are heating up in response to or in concert with the sunspot activity on the sun. And a 2 degree centigrade, not 0.6, but a 2 degree centigrade change in temperature many years ago, many centuries ago, caused the ice age. I mean, we are a third of the way to that kind of a temperature change, but going to the hot side. So I don't care if he thinks I'm being alarmist. It's a fact. We have to be looking at these things. People are losing property in the Pacific, losing one whole island has gone underwater, and the population's had to move out.
Look, when I have Linda Moulton Howe on the air and others, and they talk about Greg Little, for example, talking about Atlantis, and they see some kind of structures deep on the ocean floor, something happened on this planet a long time ago, Stan. Something's going to happen on this planet now.
Oh, absolutely. I did a whole section of one of my books on Atlantis and where I think it is, one of the many 2,000 books on it probably, but my information showed it to be, certainly in the Middle East, and to be along the Saudi Peninsula and the Persian Gulf, but that was the headquarters of it. It spread all the way to the Americas because they were all closer together at that time when the continents were almost touching. And that's why these structures are so far from where the Greek legends say Atlantis was. But I think we're going to see similar catastrophic changes. And if you want to, you can put me in the camp of the geophysicists who say it's not gradualism that causes things like the Grand Canyon or the mini Grand Canyon that formed after Mount St. Helens erupted. It is catastrophism. It is catastrophic changes. It's in the Egyptian records, it's in the Hebrew records, it's in the Indian records here, North American Indian. It is there if people just care to look.
Let me ask you this, with the Hopi prophecies, where or how do you think they got their information? I have admired their thought process, I have admired their prophecies for years, but where do you think they learned this?
Well, some of it has been passed down from what they say, what they told me, was direct revelation by Masa'u, or God, who came in his light craft. And they even have, in one of the storehouses of treasures they've got there, a Spanish conquistador helmet from when the Spanish came. And they told me the story from their lore of that, which has been passed down generation to generation. And that's how some of this passes. But some of it also comes in direct revelation to their prophecy men in these days. And I tell you what, until you witness these people straight in the eye in their own environment and sit down cross-legged with them in their homes and talk and look in their eye and see the depth of and the clarity in their soul. I mean, they don't shield like you and I do in the cities our thoughts or impressions. They call it like a spade. They do not hide stuff, and they're open and honest about that. And Holly and I both noticed it when we were with the Shungopapi tribe. It just was normal to them, but to us it was so refreshing to see the clean spirit in them, I guess is the best way to say it. And some of them, half of them are Christian people, half of them are traditionalists going with their ancient legends, but there is a happy ground between the two where the chiefs are trying to get the people to be peaceful and understand that there are great changes coming, and that's where it comes from.
Stan, does 2012 come up at all in Hopi prophecy?
I don't think so. Not exactly, but I don't know all Hopi prophecy. I have we have a joke around here, Holly and I. When you ask when the Hopi say such and such is going to happen, we say, "Oh, Hopi soon," because that's all they would say when I'd say to them, I'd say, "Well, when is this going to happen? When is that going to happen?" They'd, "Soon." You know, crossed arms and a stern look over the edge of the mesa down to the desert floor. Soon. So I do think from what they're getting prepared for that they're preparing for flooding, major flooding, intrusion of water for various reasons. They are preparing for eruptions of volcanoes all along the West Coast, driving migrating herds of people over our way across the mountains to survive.
What about Yellowstone? Did they talk about that specifically, that caldera there?
Don't recall one. They did say, as far as heat, that they are preparing, the traditionalists are preparing underground kivas of about a foot and a half thick mud walls and putting corn and bean stored in wood ash so that it won't go off. It'll keep for 30 years that way. And water in these underground kivas because they say soon the sun will grow hot and will burn the trees and the grass for a period of time. Like I think they said a few weeks. And then it will pass.
Huh.
But they are getting ready for something really exceptional in the sun.
Could that mean some kind of solar eruption that would hit us?
Those
coronal mass ejections? Boom.
Well, I tell you what, if we had a sufficient one, strike us, yes. I think what may certainly happen is that, because it's going to be prolonged over a period of several weeks, is that the sun itself, though, will increase its heat output. It's going through some changes. We've noticed that since 1991, and it's emitting new ultraviolet spectral emissions and things like that, which are telling us that the sun is in a period of change. And it is increasing its output, a small amount, but enough to affect us. And if it were to suddenly increase to a level where the temperature got really hot enough to burn trees and grass.
Yeah, how hot would it have to be to do that?
Oh.
And we're not talking about, a drought where a tree withers.
I'm thinking that because it says people will hide in caves and under rocks to get away from the heat, in the Bible, talking about the same thing.
I mean, what could a human being sustain, Stan? Honestly, do we know what the temperatures? It was very hot, 100-plus degrees in St. Louis for a couple weeks. It was tough on people. Some people died, but many did not. But what is that point, that temperature point, where human beings just go, oh, my God, they have to hide in the cave or they'll die?
Well, let me ask you this. The hot water comes out of your tap is set at around 140, 150 degrees.
Okay.
Can you hold your hand under that?
Well, I have a high pain threshold, but I really couldn't sustain it for a very long time.
You might be able to sustain it, but it's still going to burn your skin.
And I'm miserable the moment I would do that.
Well, I'd say it's between about 130 degrees and that, because people have do sustain these temperatures in the desert, 130 degrees.
All right, what would the sun have to do? What would have to happen to the sun to pop us from a 85 or 90 degree day in the summer to 130 all of a sudden, almost instantly?
It'll be over a period of a few hours, maybe 2 or 3 days, I think, when it starts, and then it will go to its peak and then and back off.
But that would be a coronal ejection on us, I think.
I don't know whether it's that, because here are other clues that are in a number of the ancient legends, and particularly in the Book of the Revelation as well. About 3 days of darkness, and the sun goes dark. Now, if you had massive sunspots all over the surface of the sun as it changed its state, I mean massive sunspots.
Oh, we're supposed to be in one of those solar minimums now, right?
We are. We're in the solar minimum. 2008 is supposed to be the solar minimum. But already, NOAA and other official agencies are running computer simulations to see how bad the sunspot activity is going to be in this 24th solar cycle that's approaching its peak at about 2012-13. It might be a double peak. We don't know, but it's peaking higher on all their forecasts than this current sunspot activity did in the 23rd cycle. It could go much higher than that because we don't know all the mechanisms of the sun completely, and we're basing this on statistics and curves and averages and new data coming in from satellites that are newly placed around the sun. But if we were to get the surface of the sun covered with a huge number of sunspots, because we know that when we have sunspots, we have increased temperatures on the sea surface, which, of course, reflects into our weather and also the whole planet, during that period of time, we would see, I think, the heat they're talking about. And because this only has to happen on one side of the sun, it doesn't have to happen to the whole sun, because it can turn around and in a period of 23 or 24 days or so, you'd have the dark spot back again if it was still as bad as it was. But it will dry out the planet. It will make it so that lightning flashes, which will occur in huge proliferation once we get that heat in, the weather engines will just drive huge clouds up, make tremendous lightning, and this will start fires so many places that we won't be able to put them out, and there will be huge winds with that will spread the fires. So I can firmly believe that when that happens, the Hopi prophecy, the biblical prophecy, will occur. And I think that's coming this fairly soon, like within a few years.
Do you have any idea? Maybe somebody can fast blast me. A tank of gasoline in a car. I've always wondered about this. Temperatures get really hot. At what point, what's the combustible temperature of gasoline in a tank? How hot does a tank have to get, Stan, before gasoline blows up? Do you know? I don't.
Well, first of all, you have to have it exposed to the air. And, you know...
So no matter how hot it gets outside, if it stays in a gas tank, it won't blow up?
Well, I wouldn't say that, because it could increase the vapor pressure to the point that it leaks out the cap and you know, out of the containment. And once you've got vapor exposed to oxygen, all it takes is a flame. I mean, you can drop a lighted cigarette in a pool of gasoline and it won't go off, but you drop a flame down, it will. Think of this as well. Many of our roads are surfaced with tar. Tar melts at a fairly low temperature.
Oh, yeah, it gets really sticky and gooey.
Can you imagine your tires melting into the road and trying to drive down the road?
Oh, and that wouldn't take too much.
No, I mean, look, I've been out in the normal heat we've had in the summer and seen the tar bubbling up in the cracks. So it won't take much.
Have you ever walked across concrete as a kid when you are barefoot in a hot summer day? It's unbearable.
Oh, I did the experiment. I cooked an egg out in the front yard, you know, out in the street one day.
Did it work?
Oh, yeah.
Over easy?
Tasty, but no.
I was going to say, over easy or what?
Pretty much like scrambled. I was trying to hold it in place. But, yeah, these things are changes. And the reason that the Bible's warned us, the Hopi have warned us, the Scallions, the Caseys have warned, is that they want people to be aware of these changes and start preparing themselves for that to survive. Or to meet their maker, whichever comes first.
Well, science advisor Richard C. Hoagland has just sent me a quick message. Says okay. Several hundred degrees, he believes, for gasoline in a tank.
All right.
Would cause it to blow up. But you know what? That is not unreachable. If you say the temperatures will get 120, 130 in a tank, it could go that high.
Oh, yeah.
Everything would be blowing up.
Yeah, I think it's a definite possibility. In fact, I saw... a movie here the other day on one of the channels, might have been Sci-Fi Channel or something, where the earth had heated up and these people were driving cars along in a suburb and their gas tank started to make a sizzling sound or a strange whistling sound. And I think that was the vapor escaping at that temperature and pressure, and of course they all got out in time before it exploded. So,
all right, how do we prepare for this case, Stan? What do we do assuming something like this really occurs?
Boy, that's a hard one.
Stay in your house? Is that going to save you?
Well, I think basements might, but certainly caves in your area would be an idea, even though they're not the best environment to try to survive in. But
power will go out. It can't sustain that kind of electrical surge.
And the thing is, you won't be able to travel on roads if it gets that hot and melts the tar roads.
Good point.
But you can do it in four-wheel, you know, like these dune buggies or what do you call them, the ATVs?
Yeah, yeah.
Those can go over land, but what you can take in provisions are limited to what you can stack on the back racks and whatever. So this might be a good investment for people that are in areas where they've got a lot of roads around them and they're going to have to go overland to get to safety. But I think to the mountains, to where you can find rock overhangs or, you know, the indentations you can make in the cliffs and whatever. I mean, the Hopi aren't going down that deep. They're only making their kivas a couple feet underground.
And this is, you say, for how long? A few days?
Probably 2 weeks maximum.
2 weeks max. Okay. Well, that's the only good thing I've heard so far, Stan, in terms of protection for us. Only a few weeks of this horror. We'll be back in a moment. Stan Deo, our special guest. Don't go away. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Stan Deo with us. And, Stan, let's talk a little bit of this flying saucer technology this hour before we take calls next. A lot of people might really not understand that you do have some experience, not only in flying saucer technology, but in flying saucer information as well.
Yep. As you kind of stated at the beginning of the show, I was once recruited by Dr. Edward Teller's group to develop my ideas and some that they had on propulsion techniques for saucer-shaped craft. Sadly, that group has been shut down, taken over by a more powerful group, nationwide or worldwide. in the late 70s. And so as a result, I don't know who controls the technology now, but it's certainly not out in the public arena.
Is it more of a black ops program?
I think it is, well, my personal opinion, although I never met him, is I know that they talked about an alien presence here on the planet and making contracts or treaties with them for exchange of technology for the aliens getting certain rights back from them. Now, I've never seen an alien, so I can't say that I can prove it that way by eyesight. But the documentation I was shown and the security people that I talked to within the organization did tell me they had actually seen them, several types. And I think that this is probably what is spoken of in Matthew 24, the Bible, where Jesus says that, look, in the end days of this age, before we go to the new happy times, you know, the millennial age, you're going to see imposter messiahs arrive with technology that will deceive many. And strange enough, I had a dream vision about that the other night that Holly's put up on the website under Dream Visions on the left there. But that's another story. But the thing is, the technologies that I was shown should have been released, I think, in the early 70s when I was inducted in the program. I think it should have been released to the public in certain parts. I can understand why we don't want to give terrorism access to real anti-gravity, and I plan to kind of honor that to a degree as far as public sales of these. But I want to teach people what the concept of gravity is, which allows the brighter out there to see how to use gravity as an energy source and as a propulsion source in the world to come. And if we do have all these disasters, which I think we will over a period of time, and it does break up the world, not just the United States, I'm looking at how do we reconstruct civilization from that. If some idiot uses an EMP bomb and destroys computers and anything with a microchip or chips in it anywhere in the world or wherever they drop them, that would put that country area back into the Stone Age unless we had new energy stuff that we could use to rebuild with. So all of the things I'm doing in my new company that Holly and I are doing are aimed at acquiring energy from some unusual sources, but to allow us to get electricity back into the grid or into local power supplies for groups of people, and to give people a mode of transport that allows them to go to seek medical help or food or water in some cases from areas that are so far away that by road it would be impossible. There's no water way to it, so little mushroom-shaped saucer craft that are one- or two-man craft. We're making them with normal technology. The anti-gravity won't go into those. But by doing so, I will teach people the concept that the bumblebee uses to fly and that the hummingbird uses to hover. There's a way to recycle your wake energy. And that's been something I've been blessed with in Dream Visions probably 40 years ago. And now I understand it and have played with it for all that time and built boats and, I'm now building these saucer craft to utilize the technology and the concept. But it uses a philosophical principle and applies it to physics, and it's this. In philosophy, if you shove your way into a crowd of people in a crowded room, you're going to get resistance.
Right.
They're not going to be happy with you.
That's true. They may even shove you back.
Oh, definitely. And that's what happens in the air or the water. When you push a boat or an aircraft through the air, you're intruding into the space where the atoms were residing quite happily before you got there. And so they push back. They reflect back your pushing energy. However, if you go into that crowded room and before you enter, you say, look, excuse me, can you just make a hole and let me come into that space?
And they move aside here and there.
Absolutely, and that's what we're doing with this technology, teaching people if you make a hole in the medium ahead of you, where the water, space, magnetic fields, gravitational fields, you can then drop your craft or yourself into that hole without disturbing the waters. And in our test with our marine version of the small-scale model boats, it's the darndest thing you'd ever see. I mean, the boat actually shoots water out ahead of it instead of out the back end and follows it. And it doesn't leave a wake. There's no trailing wake behind it. It's flat water, so you can water ski on a flat surface behind it. and it doesn't make a bow wave. It does carry waves out to the left and right of the boat that are like, if you stand on top of the boat and look down, they're like a figure eight to the left and right, you know, the piece of figure eight, and it's like waves within that. And that travels along, makes it look like a water spider, you know, hooking through the water. But that happens in the aircraft version as well.
Well, are you in partnership at all with Paul Muller, or is this totally different now?
It's different at the moment, and I got to tell you, my long-term hope is to join forces with Paul. I have sent him an email, which probably got lost in the zillions of emails he gets, but I did try to make contact with him last year to say, look, let's join forces, because you've done a lot of the homework, the technical parts of it, but the theory part here is something that will increase the efficiency of your...
Yeah, you sound like a different form of propulsion system than what he's using.
Well, yeah, he's using a ducted fan direct thrust device, which is still shoving you. But we could adapt what he has done to certainly increase the efficiency of it by about double. Less fuel, same speed and whatever. But I understand one of the big problems he has is with the Aeronautical Association here is that he's giving people the ability to take a hovercraft and not use highways and fly all over the country. And he has had to develop triple redundant computer systems.
Right, right, in case something happens.
Well, you don't want him landing up in your living room because a guy was drunk coming home.
Or falling down on you wherever you might be on the ground.
Absolutely. And see, they
I think they only go 9 feet tall, though, high, though.
The first ones he's putting out, that's true. Those are little saucer shaping. But if you look at his more like jet body four ducted fan, rotating fan version, that will go faster, higher, you know, and that one becomes a danger. But even with the one he's limiting to 9 feet, he's limiting it to 9 feet with limiters, which, you know, clever fellows will probably figure out a way to go around. And, of course, if they have an accident, then they'll be to blame, but it'll still cause an accident. What I've aimed at in the company is to try to reduce the amount of energy we're using in trucks and trains and planes and boats, submarines, and make a new kind of craft for the water and the air. And we've even started designing some things as they would have to be primary manufacturing changes to automobile manufacturers, but they're not aftermarket. But that would help there at over 60 miles an hour to save a lot of the fuel that people use now. Just by recirculating the wake energy.
Now, his unit would cost, the flying saucer one, $100,000.
Right.
What's your idea on this little two-seater?
I'm looking at something that will have a gasoline motor, some shrouding. Let's see. I think we figured out that it would be in a kit form you put together yourself, less than about $30,000.
And you make it? You could make it yourself?
Yeah.
How cool is that?
Well, I want people to understand it and be able to repair it, so that's why we're looking at making a kit for them. The first things that will come out will be scale model kits, you know, that you can get at Hobby Lobby or something like that.
Okay, all right.
And that's to show people how to steer them with the remote control and things like that, see how the air patterns work, what the attitude control works like.
Is that an actual picture that you've sent us that's on the coasttocoastam.com website, linked to yours?
That's one of our ray trace renditions. I had to take the top off of it, so I had to use a ray trace rendition. And also, what's on our craft will not look entirely like that when we go to the man version. That's the RC version. Because we're going to have a different place for the person to sit or stand than you would see in that thing there, because it'd have to be too big otherwise. And also because we're still filing patents, I can't show everything on the top shelf.
Just make them here, not in China.
Oh, listen, that's one of my biggest fears, George. I know you're being, you know, kind of lighthearted about that, but...
But I am serious, too.
Yeah, well, look at the patent office where I've been doing the patents we're doing now. They've got a Chinese desk there, and they sit there, and as soon as a patent becomes unsealed, which means it's been approved, and it's now allowed to be made public, they're sitting there watching all the new stuff coming through, and they take what they want. They take it back home. They make it, export it to everywhere they
want. Make it cheaper, unfortunately.
And they don't honor the IATA patent treaty between the United States and other countries. They don't honor that. So they just steal it. It's just absolutely stealing. And Mr. Clinton started that nonsense. And, you know, so we've looked at ways to make that, to fight that by keeping it in America as far as what Americans use, We know they're going to steal it overseas. That's a given.
That's going to happen, sure.
I'm looking at helping Americans. That's my job. I live here. I'm a citizen here, and that's what we're doing it for, is the Americans. And if they want to steal it and send it overseas, the Chinese, well, at least we'll have the technology out there for people to use.
Timetable for something like this, Stan?
For the models or what?
Sorry. For both, I guess.
Okay, well, we hope by June of next year to have our kit model thing of the aircraft and possibly the marine craft ready for manufacturing. And then it'll be up to us, to our marketing division, to get that to the public as quick as possible. And I would say after that it would be about 90 days. The tooling at this point doesn't seem to be excessive. And we're learning things every day about how to cut back costs on it so that it can get down even cheaper, what I've said. But the price I gave you, $25,000 to $30,000 for a manned version, is a wild guess, a WAG wag, because so many things could change between now and then in the sources of our product components. But that version, the manned version, will be in development as soon as we turn the kits over to the manufacturing marketing division. We're going to start on the manned version then.
Okay.
And I'll test that. I will personally test that.
You will be calling us live while you're in one. Deal?
Okay, deal. Deal.
How high will you go again with this? What's the capabilities?
Its capabilities will be like an ultralight aircraft. In fact,
that's way up there then.
Yeah, we're making it so that it will have about three times the range of a normal ultralight aircraft, the same amount of fuel, and will be a lot safer in a power failure. It'll kind of parachute itself down from the structure itself.
For a power failure to occur, what would that be? Just a complete shutdown?
Let's say you run out of fuel. Let's say you get a fuel blockage. You got some dirty fuel in there.
And this is gasoline?
We're going to have a gasoline version, and hopefully we'll be able to make a small enough diesel version to do that, or an LPG, or like a propane gas fire.
Okay. So hydrogen's not in the picture for something like
that? Well, no, I wouldn't say that, but that's a little further down the line. We've got to have something that will generate the hydrogen from another energy source,
right,
to fuel it. And we've even looked at putting hydrogen in the craft itself to reduce its mass or its weight to comply with the American standards for ultralight weights. I think we have to stay within 245 pounds. So we're talking lightweight aircraft here. And you probably won't want to go too high because of oxygen at 10,000 feet, because it gets colder. And you want to try to stay close to the ground and under the radar, just enjoy yourself, but be sensible about it. You don't want to get into the air traffic lanes.
No, that would not be a very smart thing to do.
No, we might have to govern it. I don't know, but there are a number of engineering problems we have to face when we go to the different type of power sources, and I am looking at another one, an electrical one that I will talk about one of these days, but. With the gasoline and diesel, with the combustion type engines, whether it be hydrogen or propane or whatever, these things traditionally run horizontal to the ground, and so we've had to devise new ways to run motors vertically, new types of bearing hookups to keep it from wearing out the armature too quick.
And it's doable?
Pardon?
Doable?
Oh, yeah, doable. Yeah, I mean, thrust bearings and other things we're looking at. It's just an engineering problem. It's not a concept problem. It's getting the components at the right price and the right size to fit in what we want.
Wow, Mr. Dale, is this reverse UFO technology here?
This part isn't. If you look on our website under the splash page, that purple page, and you click on energy and propulsion talking point, you will see down at the bottom of the pictures we've got there some of the long-range stuff that is kind of reverse engineering it away. I was exposed to the technology before I was recruited by Teller's group. And you'll see some chipboard down there in three layers, like a birthday cake or a wedding cake or something, with some coils and rods on it. And that was the technology I was familiar with. But the Teller Maxfield, and others, Maxfield and Sakharov, that group, had developed it beyond that by the time I joined them to the thing you see in the middle. It looks like a metal donut with flat wire toroidal coils around it. And how you use that is a secret, but that's what it looked like inside a 30-foot craft. I was shown the Polaroids of that in a meeting in the group.
Incredible propulsion, Stan.
Oh, look.
My gosh.
It is. And the thing is that I'm a teacher at heart. I like to share with folks, and I like to see young engineers and physicists' minds suddenly turn on to the new concepts and then run like crazy with their own applications of it. I'm not so vain to think that I have the the greatest mind and the only solution to everything in the world, so I want to share it. And this is what I'm doing within the confines of keeping a profitable business, you know, with proprietary property, stuff like that, but still teaching the concept. And you'll see on this page, I've gone to great lengths, in fact, what you're seeing on this technology page here in the talking point, are extracts from a paper that I have begun submitting to the IEEE, the Institute of Electrical Engineers in this country, and I discussed with them what I was doing and gave them part one to show the error in Einstein's relativity and how it affects gravity and energy, our concepts of it, how we use it. And they were so excited about it. They've taken it off now, and it's getting peer reviews now. And part two and part three, parts of that are already here before I've even turned them over to the IEEE. And they've assured me that should they go to an e-book publication of this, that we will be able to make it available to the public on our website, and we will do that in agreement with the contract that we will sign with them. But the thing about gravity, you know, I never thought that I would be challenging such a great person as Einstein or Lorentz Fitzgerald.
Or Isaac Newton.
Yeah. In fact, I just kind of hold him up on a pedestal in physics. I mean, Newton was a tremendous Christian fellow, but he was also a tremendous physicist, and he was a bit eccentric in his own way. But yet, he pioneered all of our modern physics, you know, thrust reaction-type devices and all kinds of physics applied to the formulas he devised. Well, you know, how close are we to a break?
You've got about a minute or so. Go ahead.
Okay, after break, I better talk about it. It'll probably take me a longer time, but I want to tell you a weird thing that happened to me in 1969 in my den, which got me started on this long path to finding the error in Einstein's relativity, because it was a freaky kind of supernatural thing that you know, people could see.
That's why this show is so appropriate for things like that, Stan.
Well, yeah, I at the time it happened, I thought, wow, that's really incredible. Well, what do I do with it? And then 35 years of exploration followed. But I guess we can talk about that just after the break.
Okay, let's do that. And Stan, also, I want to talk with you about your thoughts of this UFO deception and what it might really be. I haven't talked with you about this in a long time. Most of the things you and I always talk about are these incredible earth changes. So let's do that as well, all right?
All right.
All right, Stan Deyo. His website is Stan, D-E-Y-O, standeyo.com. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. Take a look at some of the things we've been talking about tonight. His flying saucer designs, his thoughts on just what will happen earthwise in the future. I'll be back in a moment. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. What strange thing happened to you, Stan, in 1969?
Well, it was just a little bit before Christmas time, and I was in Dallas at the time. I hadn't joined the Teller group thing. And my wife and I were sitting down in the den where I had kind of been allowed to put a, you know, Stanley thinking couch and a fireplace and a blackboard and a desk and the equipment that I could experiment with. And on my blackboard, you know, just a normal blackboard, black with, you know, white chalk, I was sitting down next to the desk there in a chair reading a book that one of my staff at the office had given me as an early Christmas present, and it was a paperback biography on the life of Einstein. And the wife was down there wrapping packages and stuff for Christmas, and I was reading and really enjoying this in the evening there, this biography, until I hit a line where it said Einstein was not happy with his general relativity. He knew he had an error in it.
Huh.
And the reason he did, he said, was that light coming from the sun, for instance, he said, travels across this vast space to the Earth and other places. He said, it travels across nothing, and it acts like a waveform. He says, that doesn't fit with the way I've done general relativity. There's an error there that has to be solved. So I thought, wow, a waveform. I'll go to the blackboard here, and I'll I'll draw a big sun, and I put the chalk on the left side of the board and drew this round sun, and then I put up a bunch of dots in a grid to the right of that. In fact, you can see I've recreated what I saw there. This is not the actual photo, so don't get panicky, but I've recreated what we saw because we didn't take pictures of when it happened. But anyway, I put the dots up on the blackboard, and I thought, right, I can figure out a way that like photons acting like waves and particles can actually kick themselves along through nothingness. And so I put all these dots and started making little movement of the atoms or the photons, as it was, to see if it could do that without something being in the space between the sun and the earth. And I thought, oh, no, that won't work. And I erased it in disgust at how I should even try to solve this great man's problem with drawings on a blackboard, and sat back down. So I picked up the book I was reading and really enjoying now, right? I pick it up and I look at the words on the page, and they could be in Cyrillic Russian for all it mattered. I could not understand or read a single word. My mind, somehow or another, stopped being able to read. And I mentioned to the wife, I said, you're not going to believe this, but I can't read.
You must have been freaking.
Oh, I thought, what's wrong with my mind?
Yeah, she something's said, happening. You're stroking out or something.
Yeah, and she says, don't worry about it. You know how wives are. So don't worry about it.
Have a stroke. Don't worry, Stan.
Yeah, no, she says, you were working with something on the blackboard there, weren't you? I said, yeah. She says, well, your mind's probably still over there, and it can't concentrate in this, and that's all that's happening. I said, right. She said, well, go back to the blackboard and finish what you're doing over there, and whatever it is in your mind, correct itself. And I said, right. So I went over to the blackboard thinking, what in the world am I going to do that I didn't do before? And I put my chalk in my right hand and put it up in the middle of the blackboard to think, well, what will I draw next? And as I was looking at my hand in the chalk absentmindedly, I realized there was a picture formed in the eraser marks that was so clear it was a side view of Albert Einstein's head. And I thought, wow, I must be really seeing things now. And so I turned to the missus and I said, look, I want to ask you a question. And she says, before you do, who's that picture up on the blackboard? I said, you see that? She said, oh, yeah. I said, that's Albert Einstein. And I told her, how it formed just by accident when I erased before I sat down. She says, oh, that's neat. Leave it up there. And so for a couple of days, neighbors came in, everybody looked at it, but stupid here forgot to take a picture of it. So I've recreated kind of like what it looked like in those pictures on the website there. But anyway, I then went back and sat down and could read again. And then in the weeks that followed, I started to have really lucid dreams where I could ask a question in my dream about how space works and stuff. And it actually, I would go out in like 3D space and color between the sun and the earth and see how everything worked, how gravity worked.
You get the answers that way, didn't you?
Oh, in pictures.
Yeah.
And then I had to take several years to learn the mathematics to, convey this to the physicists in their language. And when I say several years, probably about 35 years. I'm a slow learner. But now I finally have the opportunity to share that and to take this to completion. But it was just so freaky that reading Einstein, then his picture forms out of the eraser marks at random. It had to be something telling me, look, you can do it and just hang in there. And I don't know where the information came from after that. I can guess it's by the grace of God. But anyway, that's what I'm sharing with folks in this IEEE paper. And in fact, you want me to tell you how gravity kind of works generally?
Yeah.
Okay.
From your perspective.
Well, all right, from my perspective. That's fair enough. Einstein Michelson and Morley, Lorentz in the early days, Sir Isaac Newton, Maxwell, all these people looked at space as a fluid, what they call the ether, or A-E-T-H-E-R, aether space.
Right.
And they only put an A in front of it because at the time ether was
It was that. It was that snuffing out thing. Chemical.
A stuff to put you to sleep or burn or whatever. Ether, the chemical, and so they didn't want to confuse ether space with that because they called space like a fine vaporous medium, which of course ether becomes when it evaporates. So that's how they came to call it that. But anyway, these guys all thought about the effects of space, especially James Clerk Maxwell, as gravity, magnetism, electricity, all of them were functions of waveforms of certain descriptions in a fluid space.
All right.
Space. Well, the thing that kind of turned the ball around and told all the people that thought that way, go home, you're wrong, was when Michelson and Morley did an experiment to see how fast the speed of light went and if they could test the theory that the Earth was moving through ether space. And very simply, the way they did it was to take a light beam and split it in half. Half the light beam went out to the right of us as we were moving around the sun. On the other half went ahead of us and then reflected back from some mirrors they had on the surface of the Earth. Same thing with that went out to the right. And they thought, if we are moving through space, and they went through the trigonometry of it, then the light beam that goes out to the side and comes back will travel further than the one going ahead and bouncing back. And no need to discuss why, but they did find from this that there was no change in the speed of light as it traveled at greater distance on the right side versus the one going ahead. And they said, therefore, the Earth is not moving through an ether space. There is no ether space. And this experiment and the conclusions they drew and everyone else that looked at their experiment drew and repeated versions of it at that time drew was that the limit velocity in space is the speed of light. Therefore, you can't go faster or slower than that as a light waveform, electromagnetic wave. And therefore, Albert Einstein jumped on that after two other guys, Lawrence and Fitzgerald, made a fudge factor to put into what Einstein used to put into his equation. Actually, Lorentz did it before he did, but all they did was set up a fudge factor to accommodate the results of that experiment so that they could understand it. And it was a simple, simple mistake that they all made, and that was this. And you can see this. Let's suppose we have a cup of tea, you know, white tea with the cream in it, and we've stirred it up. And there's a few tea leaves that got out of the bag, and they're floating around the spinning tea.
Right.
Okay. Let's call the center of that spin the sun. And let's call those tea leaves planets. Now, look down at those tea leaves orbiting around the center of the spinning tea. Do you see any shock waves or bow waves on those tea leaves? No.
No.
They are being moved by the ether, or by the tea in this case, at the same speed as the tea or the ether. Therefore, if you did a test like Michelson and Morley did, you wouldn't detect the ether because you're not moving through it. It is moving you. That is the basic relativity concept there that they missed. When you bring that back into their equation, a marvelous thing happens. We can go many times the speed of light where you actually curl space, the fluid of space, ahead and around
you. You're talking about time travel now, Stan.
Well, I know the Israelis have recently postulated that using a torus,
yep,
a donut-shaped thing, to go back in time as long as you can surround it with exotic matter. I don't know exactly what exotic matter is, but that's what they said. I definitely know that you can see back in time. If you can go faster than light and go away from the Earth for, say, a year at that speed, and turn around and look at the light coming from the Earth and from our solar system, the light you'll be getting will be a year ago, and you can actually witness events, at least on a solar system scale, from a year ago, because you're out there catching those light rays that are going out into space. It's like we do now. We actually are using time viewing of the beginning of the universe and of galaxies that are long gone because they're, 500 million light years away. Well, 500 million years ago, they formed and did their thing, and we're just now getting the light from it. So we're seeing back in time 500 million years. As far as going forward in time, that's a different proposition, and I think we can actually take mass forward in time, but not backward, at least.
Well, that's what most scientists and physicists say, exactly that, except this Israeli physicist says no. He believes that with this bending space-time, you might be able to go back into time.
Well, all right, and I'll certainly be big enough to say that's possible, and I will tell you this. If anybody has done that in the modern history of the human race up to this point in time, then whatever they've done in the past is already set.
And by the way, this Israeli says you do not need exotic matter to do this.
Oh, did he?
Everybody else says you do.
I must have misread that.
Okay, so
he's that the other day.
Yeah, he's on the other side of the camp, and he stands alone.
Oh, that's right. He said you could have dust or something, didn't
right.
he?
Right.
That's right. That's right. I remember. Well, look, we've often had a joke with university professors arguing this time travel thing, and Now that America has seen Doctor Who, they can imagine a time cabinet being able to go back and forward in time. And I said to one of them, I said, look, let's suppose that a man invents, or a company, whatever, invents a time machine that will go back in time, forward in time, anywhere they want.
Mm-hmm.
And at that moment, the first man goes into there and disappears into the time stream.
And where did he go, by the way?
We don't know.
All right.
Backwards, forwards. He's gone into the
time stream. He's gone. Okay.
From that moment on, if there was no God, then there always was one. Now think about it. He's gone back or forward in time. He figures out a way to increase his life, to live forever, whatever. And so it doesn't matter. God always was.
True.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's a freaky thing, and it always ties their mind in a knot. I leave them, go get another canapé and do something else. But it's a mental game. But the point is, I think that certainly to this point in time, that everything that has or could be done to the timeline behind us by anybody from the future or from God or whatever has been done. The future to us is still unwritten, but to those who stand outside in the time stream, they see it like slides in a carousel that they can manipulate. Forward and backward. But to us as the observer, we're in that carousel as a fixed slide, and we can only see what's happening in our slide and guess at what's coming in the future and certainly see what has happened in the past.
I didn't know you were this technically inclined.
Really?
All these years, you know, I knew you were an expert in earth changes and climate and earthquake predictions, but I knew, you know, because obviously I've been following your career, but I didn't know you were this technically inclined.
Well, I don't know why. I guess I didn't talk about it. I know we had a good time over there in Hollywood when we did that show with you, but that was on, you know, other matters that are more common to the show. So I guess I just...
You're multifaceted, Mr. Dale.
Yes. What was it? A newspaper article or a journalist down in Australia once came out to see the lab and stuff, and he filmed it and did a full-page Sunday edition on it, and he ended up calling me the modern-day Da Vinci, and I thought, wow, that's a real plus, you know. But I just have an interest in everything around me, and am fortunate enough to be able to rationalize it in things I can share with
you. You do have some work out, a DVD, as a matter of fact, called UFOs Are Here.
Yeah.
Let's take some time before we take calls next hour. Tell me about this concept. UFOs Are Here.
Well, UFOs Are Here was a three-part documentary that was produced by Guy Baskin, a British documentary producer for the Channel 9 network in Australia. And they called me in to be, I think, the last 20 minutes of the first of three documentaries. They were only going to do one. And when they took my story and interviewed me and saw the data about the group I'd worked with under Teller there, they realized that there was a bigger story about this UFO presence and the technology that we had. So they extended and had an audience in the next one, and then flew me up to the north to look at some UFO sightings up in the Pilbara. And the upshot of it was the first one is the UFOs Are Here documentary, which was really probably the best of the lot as far as let me tell the story my way, and to see what others were saying, including Steven Spielberg and Alan Hynek. I mean, we had the who's who of UFO research in that DVD. And sadly, when the company was, the Channel 9 was being sold over to the Bond Network, they cleaned out what we call the Pizza Hut room, which was all the film canisters and tapes were, and they destroyed the masters.
Oh, no.
So we had to find a VHS copy that someone had. And I spent weeks, probably months, tidying it up and restoring it from, you know, how
the best way you could, I guess. Yeah.
And it's come up really nice. And so I made a deal with Channel 9 for historical purposes, and we pressed 1,000 copies of it to share with folks because they thought it was important as well. So now, in that, obviously at the time, if you see the DVD, you'll see that it was talking from a position in 1977, I think it was, about what people knew about the UFO situation and what the experts were saying about the alien. Now, as I said to you before, I am not sure, you know, I have not seen an alien, but I know from biblical accounts and from Hopi accounts and other accounts in the Middle East that beings that were not from around here but were humanoid have visited Earth according to these records, for thousands of years. And so I think probably, in my opinion, that these are beings that, the majority of them anyway at this point in time, are beings that don't have our best interest at heart, and it's due to a war that's happening in a universe that's concentric to our own, maybe several, you know, parallel universes. And this is why I'm born in a cosmic conspiracy. The first messiahs, in quote, that you see in flying saucers arriving say, "We mean you no harm," like the movie V.
The To Serve Man, the Twilight Zone. You remember that one?
Yes. That
same
thing. We're on the menu there.
Yeah.
But it's an even bigger, well, actually, I suppose it could be the same way. You could treat it that way here. What we're having happen now is the world has multiple crises that you and I and many of your guests have talked about, multiple serious crises for humanity and the world, and they're all coming to a head now. And so we're all saying, hey, can somebody fix this? I mean, hey, you know, God, are you out there? I mean, hey, we're in trouble. And then suddenly in fly, our quote-unquote alien messiahs who, you know, say, look, we created you, blah, 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 we've come to help you, just follow the rules that we set up for a global government, and we'll appoint a leadership here and give them technology to help you. Now, what I'm telling you comes out of Ezekiel in the Bible. So, you know, it's written in Old English and Bible speak, but it's there, talking about an alien or a group of alien gods, it says, who come to Earth and help the leader, the Antichrist leader of this age, to take down the strong fortresses of all the great nations and to rule the world for a short time. And that's the great deception coming, and it's going to fool a lot of people to go to church every Sunday into thinking that, oh, well, yeah, that must be the Messiah.
Yeah, and it's not.
It's not. And we are warned many times in Scripture, beware the fake first and hold out for the real guy.
Stay with us, Stan. We're going to be back. We're going to take phone calls next. By the way, the L.A. Times did a huge expose on that Haitian UFO that we thought looked so great, even though we warned everyone that it probably wasn't real. Well, they found the guy in Europe who created it, and they did admit he was darn good. We're going to take your questions now with our special guest, Stan Dale. Hey, by the way, you know, we posted a couple Digicam pictures up there. The second one, there's Shirley Jones, Marty Ingalls, and me. But the one on the top, of course, is our engineer, Steve Carr. It's his birthday, so we got him a little present. Take a look at that. But we have just noticed, primarily because of some of you have fast-blasted me, the television set that is in that picture. It's the first Digicam ICOM at coasttocoastam.com. If you look very closely, and this is not a gag, folks, you look very closely at that television right behind Steve's hiney, you will see a picture of what looks like an alien with these huge black eyes. I kid you not. It's an image in a television that is not on. It really is a very bizarre picture. And that's the second Digicam. I might have said the first Digicam icon. It's the second one there. Take a look at the television monitor in that look of that alien. Strange stuff, Stan, isn't it? What's happening on this planet?
It is, George. I've noticed, I'm sure you have too, that there are an increasing number of sci-fi movies and series and newspaper articles on UFOs and aliens and our encounters with them. And you could say, well, gee, that's a conspiracy, but I think more of the truth of what's matter is that people that are watching these shows do so because their interest in the subject is being whetted by something else. And so the manufacturers of these programs are doing what the audience will pay or to watch or will watch on the commercial channels. And I think this is because a general awareness of the increase in UFO activity is running through the people, the population of the entire world. And I think we live in incredible times. I mean, just so much is happening that has been talked about off and on through the ages, but we're in that generation to see all these changes. And of course, Holly disagrees. She says, I want to see the good stuff on the other side. But I see it as a marker telling us, hey, we're about to put an end to all this. We're going into a great time on the planet where we're going to rebuild it and do it right. So, personally, I'm just quite excited by
it. Well, I hope you're right too, Stan. Let's take some calls. This hour is going to fly by. First time caller line, you're on the air with Stan Deo on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Randall. I'm in Pine Grove, Pennsylvania. I think it was about six, almost 7 years ago, I heard Stan on an interview with Art Bell, and it was very fascinating. And if I remember, Stan was in Australia. He was doing black ops projects and research, reverse engineering on UFOs, and then he was in exile, wasn't on the best graces with the program people and the high elites. And his story is very interesting. I'd like to hear a short narrator about his story, his perspective. And for the longest time, if I'm not mistaken, he was agnostic, and he didn't get to where he's at with his views and beliefs just frivolously or overnight.
Okay, was that you, Stan?
Yeah, it was me. I mean, Art did a show with me. The first show we did was in 1995. After my brother Glenn, who lives in Washington State, had called and said, "Man, you ought to talk to this guy on his show, you know, and share some information with him." And that's how Art and I met first
started.
Time.
You want to give us just a capsule of what you guys talked about then?
Well, at the time, I was doing earthquake research myself and seeing an increase in them. And we started out with the Navy forecast map I was working on and forecasting earthquakes. And from time to time after that show, we did other shows with Art. It would be, you know, as a result of some of the earthquake research, which is a minor part of what I was doing in life. And what Randall was talking about, I think, is that certainly the technology that I'm talking to you about today didn't happen overnight. I had to gain knowledge from the source of the dream vision I had in the beginning, and then from working in the Project Teller's project, and then after that on my own dime and, you know, budget, building and testing things and learning about the technology or the concepts of the physics and applying it to the real world. Art heard about that as a process of us talking and interviewing, and we did spend some time on that subject after that. So, yeah, I that's kind of how it happened. I mean, I definitely was not agnostic, but I just wasn't an avid believer, you know, or follower of the Bible until I left the Teller organization mm-hmm. and was nearly killed. And then I, you know, was on the run out in the desert for 6 months. And I eluded one CIA guy and a couple FBIs that were there that shouldn't have been, but. Anyway, I realized that my time was short, and I got real serious with thinking about where I was going after this, and that's where I made my peace with our Creator, and after that, things fell right in line, and although it took 30 years, I was able to get my passport and U.S. citizenship back, and that's another story in itself.
And finally got your life back, I guess.
Yeah, look, it's like starting all over again, like I had a 35-year break in my life here, and then come walking back in and doing what I wanted to do 35 years ago now. So I'm obviously pushing it along, but I'm quite excited about it. I mean, just to be able to finally start telling this out and showing people rather than letting them think, oh, this Deo guy is off on another rant about mystical technologies junk. I'm actually going to be able to show people and hold them in their hands basic technology. In fact, although it is not the exact model I'm using, on that webpage I've got a still and a movie of Jean-Louis Nadine's craft that he copied from the Hatter craft over in England. And it is a flying, working model flying saucer that uses some really, you know, leading-edge model aircraft technology. But I want you to see that because what his does, mine will do even better. And it actually flies around and does some incredible things at an airport, and it is marvelous. So look at that and realize that what I'm talking about is going to be one step above this.
And not too far away, Stan.
Not too far away, no.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to the show. You're on the air with us. Hi.
This is me?
Yeah, go ahead, you.
I'm from Illinois.
All right.
And one thing with all your Earth changes is you really didn't mention anything about asteroids.
Asteroids, and because her line's so bad, I'll try to mimic what she was trying to say. Are there dangers? Of course there are, Stan.
Oh, of course there are. And, you know, I go back to my kind of ultimate guide in the Book of Revelation. If it tells about something impacting the Earth, okay. you know, I'll look at that possibility in our lifetime. And then I put together with the knowledge that Holly and I were given at Air Force Space Command when we were invited there, talking to their expert in, you know, off-world or near-Earth orbit object detection, asteroids, meteors. I realized that we do have clear and present dangers from about 5,000 chunks of stuff around the sun. And they have calculated a number of these, but there's still a number undetected by mass and orbit. And the thing is, as they told me, we've calculated the orbits based on current gravitational condition. But if the sun does something funny, or if a rogue comet comes in or something to destroy the equilibrium, it could change subtly a lot of these orbits, which we'll then have to recalculate and see when they're going to collide with the Earth. And certainly there are collision dates in the next 35 years or so, at least one that we know of, are near miss. And the Bible speaks of a burning star falling into the waters and polluting them with poison that kills a certain number of the fish, et cetera, et cetera. And there's another one that hits the Earth. There's two impacts told of. And, you know, okay, it's one of the things we factor in. I guess it makes living on coastal areas where tidal waves from an impact wouldn't be clever. So, you know, you factor that into your next move. But when push comes to shove, you can prepare for everything that you could possibly think of, and you'll end up doing nothing but prepare. So you prepare to a certain comfortable level and get back to your life and you know, stay a part of the community and family life and realize that, okay, you may die at an unexpected time, but be assured that it's appointed for man to die. You live till you get killed or old age takes you. So it's just the manner of it and the timing of it that bothers people. So I think it's important for us to make sure that when we die, what happens to us after that is taken care of. And in the meantime, that we provide for our families the best we can.
Man, you have changed and evolved over the years, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. I have to admit it.
Hey, you know the maps we were talking about, Casey, Scallion,
yeah,
Toy?
Yeah.
Is it possible that those changes, those incredible changes, especially to the United States, the North American continent portion, might be caused by an asteroid that lands in the ocean? Is that possible?
Oh, yeah. Look,
that creates these islands you were talking about.
Well, look, yeah. Anything like that, like the meteor impact that made the Yucatan, or like made the Gulf of Mexico off the Yucatan Peninsula, that happened, you know, eons ago. But it broke up that area, submerged part of the continent, and it caused repercussions on the other side of the planet in the Persian Gulf. I mean, great movements in the land. So, yes, that could trigger already precipitous type balances of tectonic plates pushing against each other. They could just push them over the edge, or it could make new waves in the surface of the Earth that just brings destruction in a lot of places we didn't expect. But yeah, you're right. An impact from something like that could trigger the new United States land map.
East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast time. Go ahead.
Hey, George, it's Mark in Atlanta.
Hey, Mark.
Just WGST here.
Sure, thank you.
I heard Stan years ago, and I never heard him say how fast these vehicles would go. I'm talking about the ones that you worked on, the real stuff. I mean, we're talking 25,000, sublight, warp. What are we talking about?
Well, the only ones I was aware of were down in the Mach 17, Mach 30 range in that area. Like, well, escape velocity from the Earth is around 17,500 or so, and it was in excess of that. And
yeah,
you could
great.
Do that. You could do that in the atmosphere. But I've got to tell you, explain this a little bit more.
Okay.
You couldn't do it with a normal aircraft that was pushing air. It has to be one of these entrainment gravity craft so that the crew and the ship have their molecules are all pumped up with extra energy when they're going to make a turn. And that's so that when they turn, it won't flatten them all against the wall. And it dilates time, just like Einstein predicted. And when you turn a corner at, say, 20,000 miles an hour on board, time slows down for you, and you can have a cup of tea and play a game of cards while you turn that corner. But to the outside view on the Earth, you turn that corner in an instant, in a fraction of a second. But it you can't cheat physics, so something has to give, and it's the passage of time. So, yes.
All right. Thanks for that question. Next up, Wild Card Line, you're on with Stan Deo on Coast to Coast. Hi.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi, this is Andrea from Reno.
Hi.
I'm from the www.myspace.com/Lonkert,
Sure. Yeah, part of the Friday group. Go ahead.
Yes. I had a couple of questions. I was wondering if either one of you thinks that aliens from other worlds will make themselves publicly known anytime soon.
Let's go one at a time. Go ahead,
okay.
Stan.
Yes, Andrea, I think that superhumans, from whether they're from a concentric universe or from another planet, I think they'll be concentric universes, but I think they are being gated in here to our world, and they will make themselves known in, I'd say, probably the next 2 or 3 years, because our global crises are coming to a head. Next question.
Do you have any insights on the year 2012 and aliens and the global Earth changes?
Well, you see, I think that the aliens are really beings that are part of a civil war in the heavens, you know, in the concentric or parallel universe. Just from reading old documents, that's all I base it on. And I think that they are manifesting here because they are being put here by the creator of everything. And it's to resolve the conflict in that civil war here by doing it here on Earth as a virtual courtroom. And to that end, I think we will see them appearing and in different forms, different shapes, in the immediate future, and I think that their presence will be explained as a good thing, and they may even divide themselves into two, saying, we're the good aliens, and here are the bad little gray critters, and we're going to get rid of them for you and do you a favor and solve your planet's problems. As far as 2012, I know that that's on some of the interpretations of the dating of the Mayan calendar, and it also shows in some of the biblical dating I've done in the Vindicator Scrolls book, but 2012 will fall just at the beginning of the peak of sunspot cycle 24, which is predicted to be pretty big. And at that time, I think big things will happen. And if that's the case, we're looking at some massive Earth changes in the next, 4 or 5 years. That take care of it, Andrea?
You got it. Thanks, Stan. Next up, Wildcard Line, your turn with Stan Deo. Hi there.
Hi, this is Andy.
Andy, where might you be?
Oh, I'm in Venice, California.
Oh, not too far. Not too far at all. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask you and Stan about sets I have, and it is, I hear a lot about aliens and these people coming from outer space, these visitors, and I actually wanted to put forth the notion that they're not from outer space. They're time travelers, and they're actually us. They're you become in the future. That's why they're kind of humanoid looking, and that is the future of mankind. And they're coming here because we become sterile in the future, and we have to come back and harvest fresh DNA. We do, because that it's a very simple reason. Birth control and environmental changes, they cause us to be sterile in the future, and we actually mutate, you know, evolutionary style into that, and we also, you know, we're becoming genetic engineers, godlike. Well, we're created in the image of God, and
it's not a far-fetched theory
God,
at all.
God looks like a man. God looks like a guy, like a human being, and that's why we are in his image. And I don't know what the aliens, if they're in the image of God, because that's what we become when we see ourselves as creators and become godlike.
Maybe mutants?
I'm sorry.
Maybe a mutant, huh?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. They travel through time to guide us and turn us onto a little bits and pieces of information as we need it, as we can handle it. But we're being prepped, even through the media, science fiction, novels, movies. Everything that you're seeing is getting us ready to accept what's going to be a revealing. And I mean, it's weird that it's kind of like Revelations. I don't know. I'm not a really religious person, but there's going to be a revealing. And what the revealing actually is we are going to become aware and be able to use the other 90% of our brain. And that makes us dangerous to one another. And so they're guiding this slow transition that's going on, and it has to happen this way. And I just want you to know this. I don't have a background. This information comes to me from them directly.
How so?
Because they have certain people that they need to gather information from. They have certain people that they need to gather DNA from. I am not DNA.
All right, let's get your reaction, Stan, before we hit the break. What do you think?
Andy, look, I'm going to have to disagree with you on that. I think that they are there, and they are certainly passing information to you and to a number of other contact persons. But this is part of the deceptive landing I'm talking about. The old records that the Bible and some of the other Semitic documents record, and even some of the Egyptian, does say that that they're not from the future. They are beings from our past, in essence, from before we were even created. And when the story that you get from these beings differs with the oldest records we have that are reliable, I have to personally say, look, Andy, I think you're being duped, and just be very careful. There's more at stake here than just your life.
All right, stay with us. We're going to be right back. We're going to take final phone calls with Stan Deo. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Stan, any conferences or any trips coming up for you?
No, George, I'm afraid not. I'm horribly busy with the legal and corporate structure things, and was setting up the new labs and buying in equipment. So I just can't go anywhere right now.
No, you are jammed to the gills. Okay, let's take final calls now with Stan Deo. Let's pick it up. First of all, west of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hello there.
Yeah, hi, Stan. This is Robert from Moorpark, California.
Hi, Robert.
Hi. Yeah, I have like to hear your comments on an experimental saucer-shaped craft. It would be basically an airplane wing, make it out of rubber and connect it together, but imagine that being metal with twin turbines, one going one direction and the other one going the other direction to stabilize it, and it would suck the air from the bottom and blow it over the top, which is curved, so you would get your lift from the and then it would take the air from the top of it and blow it over the bottom. In other words, it'd be a fixed wing aircraft, but in a saucer shape.
Is this something you designed?
It's something I've been thinking about for a while, because I know a helicopter needs a rotor on the back of it. And I was thinking if you had just one turbine, it would spin, make the whole thing spin. So if you had another one going in the other direction, it would be able to lift using the principle of the wing principle of the friction going over the top of the wing. You know how a wing is curved, so it creates a drag which lifts the plane up off the ground.
What's your reaction to that, Stan? And once again, tell us your propulsion system, Stan Deo.
Well, this is a portion of the concept we use, Robert. You're on the right track. There are a number of engineering problems you will encounter building that craft, and with the two-turbine idea, just going to what you suggested, you can do this with one turbine if you want, because there's a chip that's readily available in the market now that senses gyroscopic drift in a craft, and it will allow you to send a signal to little vanes, if you wish. You can see it on our website there in the Jean-Louis Nadine video. These little vanes turn, and they counter the torque just simply by directing the airflow over the upper wing. What you've suggested is there are a number of patents that have been granted now to various people other than myself, which use that type of propulsion. It is not as efficient as you would think. The Avro car that was done by A.V. Rowe in Canada in the late 50s had a similar idea. And they got ground lock or ground effect lock, and instead of breaking free from the ground, their jet turbine device, saucer device, stuck to the ground and hovercrafted. So there is a solution to that, and my propulsion system does do that, allowing you to reuse the air, the wake, in a manner that does not lock you to the ground, and in a manner that allows you to store energy of several cycles of the engine in your entrainment field, which in essence means you can use, depending on the geometry of your aircraft, you can use 60 to 75% less fuel to get the same velocity. Does that answer your question, Robert?
Very good there. Thank you, Stan. First time caller line, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Trevor in Twin Falls, Idaho.
Hi, Trevor.
How are you guys?
Nice to have you with us.
Oh, I appreciate you taking my call. Actually, I've got sort of a two-part question, and I'll try to make it brief. I know one of the callers right before your break, you know, talked about, you know, time travelers coming back and so forth, and these aliens being us. And I sort of, you know, it seems more like science fiction. In fact, I just saw a movie that seemed pretty similar to that. But I guess my question to you, Stan, would be that, you know, just based on what I've been hearing tonight, sounds like you're a fairly religious person, and at least have some religious beliefs and so forth, because you've referenced, you know, things from the Bible and that sort of thing. And I'm not an overly religious person, but I'm just kind of curious to see if there's been any consideration, you know, given to the fact, you know, and you had warned about, you know, being fooled by, you know, false messiahs and that sort of thing. And I just wonder if there's been any consideration given to, you know, these reported alien beings being, you know, essentially demonic creatures, you know, because we talk a lot about, you know, belief in God and so forth, but there doesn't ever seem to be any reference to, you know, these creatures potentially being from Satan, you know, meant to sort of lead us astray and essentially get us focused, you know, on something that, you know, is going to take us down a different path. And so, you know, that was kind of my first question. I just wondered if there had been any consideration given to that at all.
Well, Trevor, yes. When you say I'm a religious person, technical point there, I'm a Christian believer. You know, Jesus is my Messiah, but that doesn't mean that I am a religious, which kind of denotes somebody's a little bit of a fanatic in following a religious discipline. I'm certainly a Christian believer and not affiliated with any particular church, but certainly with the concept that the Lord's coming back soon to set things right. Now, as far as the demonic aliens, I call them the fallen ones, and I think that there are two groups among them, that those that look like humans, slightly taller, probably fairer skin, and if you look at the skin in the sunlight, probably slightly iridescent, like oil on water, and that would be from scales rather than from the normal skin tissue we have. And those beings are the fallen ones cast down here for after this great battle in the heavens. And I think that the little grays may be a form of bionic robot or automaton, what do you call it, androids that they may have made to create bad guys for them to knock off to fool us once we discover that there is a deception coming. And that's just my opinion on that, Trevor. What's your next question?
Excuse me. I guess my next question would be, you know, in regards to the time travel, and it's been something that, you know, I've thought about before as well, and you've certainly made some you know, you've opened my eyes to some different ways of thinking about that. But I guess ultimately I sort of wonder, like, you know, there's been so much, no pun intended, there's been a lot of time, you know, and effort and so forth expended, you know, and I'm familiar with the fact that Einstein, you know, says that it's theoretically possible. But I just ultimately wonder what sort of benefit there would be for mankind for us to develop some type of time travel, especially given the limitations that we already know and the things that, you know, being able to travel back in time and not being able to do this and that. And I just wonder why so much resources, why they're expended when we know that, you know, when they're just, it just doesn't seem like there would be a lot of benefit for mankind, because there's a lot of, like, sort of doom and gloom, you know, the naysayers about, you know, as soon as time travel is developed, you know, it would ultimately end to the destruction of mankind. And I just wonder, you know, who's behind the push for that, and, you know, if it's sort of you talk about the black ops people, if it's something that's being developed or pioneered something that's being developed. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, Trevor, it does. I don't know if there's an organized push behind such research. Certainly it's being funded, as are many other projects that are probably even more nonsensical. But there was a science fiction series on 7 days, I think it was, something like that, where the military could jump back 7 days in time and avert certain tragedies. That would be a benefit if you could do that, but obviously that was an altruistic look at the use of going back in time, and certainly those who have the money and power to control that, I don't think in this day and time would be free of avarice or, you know, a self-interest in making whatever happens in the past happen or change. I do believe, however, that the creator of us has that technology, otherwise he wouldn't be in charge of everything in all time and be able to anticipate things in the future and account for them. So therefore, I think should we get close to doing that and trying to jump out of the crib and into the time stream that he controls, that there would be a patch put over that spot and we wouldn't be able to succeed. That's, again, my opinion, Trevor.
Stan, Earth Changes question. Do you see big tornadoes, more of them this year?
Yes, I think we'll probably see quite a few. The official stats, I think, say that we're going to have about 1,564 this year, and that's estimated on the figures that we had up to the end of July. In 2004, we had 1,819 tornadoes, but I think the issue is we're having stronger ones, and we're having more killer tornadoes. Now, they're forecasting 30 killer tornadoes for this year, which is the highest that we have on record here on our files. And last year we had 25, which means that, you know, the tornado killed at least one person. We're seeing the forecast here at 30 for the year. I think over the next 4 or 5 years, tornadoes, hurricanes, violent windstorms, and even microbursts will become a common thing and a frightening thing because they will be so extreme. I think they may even revise the extreme limit of some of the scales they've got now just during that period of time.
Okay, thank you for that. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with Stan Deo on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good to talk to you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Hey, George, this is your Oscar exorcist professor. I've been a longtime caller to Coast to Coast.
Ah, yes, you have.
And Stan Deo knows me real well. I spent over $3,000 talking to him during his Australian years. Hello, Stan.
Hi, how you going, Professor?
Good to talk to you, man. Look, George, the importance of Stan Deo as a regular guest on your show, I know right now you can't fathom how important this man is and his knowledge in so many different areas. He's not a young guy, but he's very experienced. And I just want to tell you congratulations for having him on. Thank
Absolutely.
You. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Look, Stan, there's things you used to bring up on the show in the past. I would like you to reiterate, if you would, that is the underwater bases, how these craft can go underwater. Bill Cooper put a forward in his book in which he saw a craft the size of an aircraft carrier going in and out of the water, but the water was dripping off the air around it. Please tell us about those underwater bases again. Tell us about the manufacturing facilities in Bahrain. And also, George, I've seen the future in dream visions, and Stan helped with one of my dream visions, things that I told him. He's the first person I told it to in 1998, and things that in my dream vision actually happened to him in his life, and I saw the coming kingdom of iron and clay that takes over this world. And I can tell you the two factions are going to be divided. It's going to be a play with King Harry, which is Harry, Prince Harry now, leading one faction, and believe it or not, Arnold Schwarzenegger leading the other. He is called the Anti-Beast. I've seen glimpses of the future. And Harry's the real Antichrist, but they're going to use Schwarzenegger, whose name interpreted means black darkness. You've heard how people describe these shadow beings, of which I've been plagued all my life.
Sure.
Since I was 3 years old with these shadow beings. But these shadow beings are described as black darkness. And you're going to have the forces divided. The manifestation is coming. People need to read Childhood's End. When they get right there at chapter 6 on about page 66, they'll find what the manifestation is going to be like. That is one part of this coming kingdom of iron and clay, described in the book of Daniel as well as any place.
All right. Now, just let me quickly get to the question about the propulsion system. We'll go on. the gravitational field that forms around these saucer craft will allow them to go underwater. And I think under certain circumstances, they might even be able to go into solid structures, into caverns and stuff that are sealed from the outside by rock. For gravity to exist, you have to have spin, at least at an atomic level. And the increased spin creates an inertial field, which we've been able to illustrate with our watercraft, showing the effect in the water, how it would look in a gravitational field. And it's moving so fast, it does create an inertial force in the air that the water drips off of, and that's why they can go underwater. They're still subject to dynamic pressures under there, and I don't know how that's compensated for, but I hope that answers the question.
Stan, the Earth changes that we've been talking about on this program all day, they seem to be happening quicker, seem to be the tip of the iceberg, if I can use that as a phrase.
Yeah, well chosen.
Do you think each year, because it seems like we have record heat, record cold, do you think each year we're going to have more and more records?
Oh, I think so. For probably the next 5, 6, 7 years, maybe 8, going into the next cycle and to the downside of it. But anticipating this, we should be ready to accommodate as best we can without panic. And as I say, what we're doing here in our company is our bit to develop products, including some kind of portable above-ground garden systems that you can put together with prefab sheets and stuff we're making. We're designing them, started making them for sale yet, but things that will help people reconstruct during that period of time. I'm looking on the other side of that stuff now, then skipping to the good part where we rebuild.
East of the Rockies, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi.
Hi, this is Charles from Palm Coast, Florida, and I am just really impressed that this guest is on a cutting edge. I believe he has latest information. I heard also that the Earth had enlarged from 6 to 12 inches this year. I just wonder, among other things, how long this is being monitored, because I believe, as he apparently does, that the Earth has been expanding probably since the beginning of the Earth. And now, I am convinced, you might laugh, I'm convinced I have the theory of everything. I sit down with people, I talk for about a couple hours, and there's silence, and they tell me they're absolutely fascinated because it is consistent with biblical text. And the Earth expansion, I believe, is a part of the Big Bang, or for the faithful, the moment of creation. And I can answer a question that religious people and the scientific community just can't resolve between them, which is older, the Earth, 6 to 10,000 years according to biblical text, or 4.7 billion years according to the soil samples. The answer is they're both correct with the fluid nature of time, et cetera, et cetera. I can tell you why the Earth rotates. It's just part of that explosion.
Charles, you're going to love when I get my paper from the IEEE and permission to print it up, because part of what I discuss in there is a very obvious phenomenon that occurs in the entire universe. That is the same-handedness, like galaxies spin a certain way, and their star systems spin that same way, and the planets around the star system spin that same way until something upsets them. We're calling it the Genesis vector.
Stan Dale, we're running out of time. Give Holly a hug for all of us, and you, my friend, invited back anytime you want.
Thank you, George, and let's get together again and make some documentary when we get some stuff to show you, eh?
Absolutely, and I'm looking forward to seeing this flying saucer. I might even pick one up myself. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, happy birthday, by the way, Steve, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, Art Bell, gosh, how many other people? I can't remember everyone, and maybe me. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.